This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Indiana Citizen is a publication that's available online out there if you want, as some citizen, many citizens here in Indiana, and particularly here in Northwest Indiana, want to do, is to keep track of the opportunities for to get involved in the community and certainly civic engagement, which is one of the terms that is used by the Indiana Citizen as part of its name. Indiana Citizen is a nonpartisan, nonprofit platform that is out there, and we are talking with one half of the creation team of the publication, and by that I mean Bill Moreau, because Bill and his wife Ann helped put this thing together, and Bill is with us to talk about not only the Indiana Citizen, but some of the major topics that are in some of the latest editions of Indiana Citizens in the Wells. And first, Bill, thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Oh, Chris, thank you for the invitation.
Well, tell us first about the idea behind the Indiana Citizen, which I know basically goes to the creation of the foundation, which is the 501c3 behind it.
Right. So as my wife and I started thinking about my retirement from the practice of law at the end of 2019, you know, and We set aside a chunk of time for spoiling our grandchildren and a chunk of time for doing the travel that we had been unable to do. There was still a good chunk of time that we thought we ought to give something back to the state of Indiana that has given us so much. And so the Indiana Citizen Education Foundation was formed with the goal of working on Indiana's really persistent civic health crisis. Chris, I know you cover this very carefully, but over the last couple of decades, the metrics that measure a state's civic health, really for Indiana, has been those metrics have been going the wrong direction in terms of registration, civic literacy, and turnout on election day. So last year in 2020, we worked on registration, education, and turnout. And this year, you know, being a non-election year, we're really focused on the education component of our mission.
Do you think that focusing on the issues involving getting people to get out to the polls turned out in success with the turnout that showed up in last year's elections?
Well, Chris, this is one of those moments in which our supporters encouraged us on election day to rush out and declare victory. Mm-hmm. Turnout was up. Certainly, it was up about 9%. So we cracked 3 million for general election turnout for the first time. But the rest of the country was up almost twice that, 17%. So when the dust finally settles, yeah, Indiana will have had record turnout in 2020, but our ranking among the 50 states in the District of Columbia will actually go down. So that was a disappointment.
Mm-hmm. Do you get any reaction or comments or feedback, certainly, from people who more or less see the Indiana Citizen, follow along very closely, as they probably did during this past election, and certainly, if anything, give you ideas for some of the next topics that you look into?
Well, right. As I mentioned in 2020, we wanted to make sure that we could provide as much unbiased information about the candidates on the ballot. So we had that feature that turned out to be pretty complicated to construct, in which you could go in, put your address in, and the names on your individual ballot would pop up, and you'd be able to click on those names and go to profiles that we wrote, that were all written by a team of journalists. And so we got very high marks for providing that kind of information, and we had a specific target of first-time voters to try to get them the information they needed to cast an informed ballot. But, you know, as 2020 turned into 2021, our supporters were saying, well, please, you know, don't, you know, just park the car in the garage for 2021. Build on this information platform. And as luck would have it, we were contacted by Franklin College, and we were asked to partner with them and their Statehouse file project. So we added boots to the ground, boots on the ground at the Indiana State House in this last session of the General Assembly.
That seemed to be a very popular way to be able to not only expand what you have available to you to be able to put out there, in this case, online in the print form, as well as talk about it later and bring up for future discussion as to having organizations like the State House file available out there. And I'm doing their best to certainly continue to educate young journalists as coming out of the School of Journalism at Franklin College.
Yeah, it's been a wonderful partnership, Chris. So you have senior journalists like our editor-in-chief, Kevin Morgan, who mm-hmm. spent his career at the Indianapolis Star working with these undergraduate journalism students at Franklin College. And, of course, our platform is free and accessible to everybody across the state. It's really been a great partnership.
We're talking with Bill Moreau, who is a retired attorney, and he has some print experience in his background in life, as well as now being the co-founder and president of the Indiana Citizen Education Foundation. He, along with his wife Ann, are the founders and keep the project alive, the Crossroads of Civic Engagement, as it's being called. Bill, in the issues here of the Indiana Citizen that are out there, we know they're focusing this time around on the next big project, which has really not even technically begun, and that is to say the work that the Indiana General Assembly must do beginning this month on coming up with the district maps for not only for the legislative but for the congressional districts. And you've spent a lot of time and a lot of ink, if you want to call it that, certainly printer ink for somebody that prints them out, talking and giving in more details and more views as well, points of view, different points of view, I'm sure, on the topic here. I have some of the latest ones in front of me, and one of them is the latest discussion that was brought up by members of different faiths that showed up at the State House with a single message about what the lawmakers should be doing as far as the redistricting process is concerned. And you also have some comments, too, in more detail that was prepared for you by Alan Mills, who is a member of the foundation, but he's also certainly an educator and an intellectual in his own right. Will you tell us a little bit about Alan Mills and about the comments that he put forth that's in the latest issue?
Well, right, Chris. Yeah, you've hit several key points all at once, beginning with our focus on the once every 10-year process known as redistricting. Mm-hmm. And if you get a chance to go to IndianaCitizen.org, you'll quickly see that the emphasis that we're placing on redistricting. In fact, we built a little library along the way called our Redistricting Resource Center. And I say with a great deal of pride, given such what a small organization we are and with our limited funding, we have devoted more coverage to redistricting than any other publication in Indiana. And we just posted a very thoughtful analysis by an African-American lawyer by the name of Alan Mills, a senior partner at the Barnes & Thornburg firm and who's a member of our board of directors. And his theme is why racial justice requires fair maps. And his point is that you can't expect for racial justice policies to advance or bad policies to be thwarted when you have supermajorities like have existed over the last 10 years in Indiana. And so he's making the case for how fair maps, would be drawn to actually promote competition between the two parties, would result in a more representative state Senate and state House of Representatives. I mean, just one of the statistics he uses is, that the 2020 census, which of course is driving the redistricting process, 2020 census says that about 23% of Hoosiers are non-white, and yet only 10% of the members of the General Assembly are. So I really encourage everyone to read Alan's thoughtful analysis about why racial justice requires fair maps.
And I know that the Indiana Citizen covers all types of topics from all types of viewpoints, and some of them even come up here into Northwest Indiana, where you've had opportunities to speak with Republican leadership in Lake County about various topics. And if you will, tell us a little bit what Dan Dumasich had to say in one of his columns. It's very interesting, and you have to go in, have to go into the Indiana Citizen website and take a look at it in particular, and go in and find the article and read it for yourself.
Well, I've got to confess that Dan and I became good friends over the years through a relationship with another prominent former Lake County Republican by the name of Bob Grand. Dan looked at an article in which some Democrats were complaining about the 2011 maps. And, you know, his reaction, it was, Democrats, you know, ought to eat what they served back in 2001. And so I really encourage your listeners to look for former Representative Dumage's piece, because it can fairly be said that he was on the receiving end of gerrymandering that was done when the Democrats were in control of the House in 2000. And one, our position is gerrymandering is wrong, whoever does it. And for those of you in Northwest Indiana, and you just saw what Democrats that control the Illinois legislature did. It was just an awful exercise in gerrymandering. And it's wrong whichever party does it. When you manipulate those lines in order to try to predetermine who's going to win an election, we started calling that a secular civic sin. I know that's kind of an alliterative mouthful, but doggone it, Chris, when you use power like that to perpetuate power, we know it also has an effect on driving down turnout, right? When voters figure out that the races are predetermined in advance, it has a chilling effect on turnout.
I know that it's not all you, Bill Moreau, and Ann, as part of the, I guess, what the might call the more public side of the Indiana Citizens out there, and for that matter, Kevin Morgan, who's your editor-in-chief. You have a rather deep bench to be able to work with a number of contributing writers who are very experienced journalists and in their own particular fields, attorneys and the like. And there's some interesting people who have just, I guess, come on the writers list that people may have read over the decades. And I'm thinking in particular people, and still out there as well, too, people that are still out there writing and producing. We're talking like John Schwantes, who you get to see on Indiana Week in Review, and Indiana lawmakers on public television and radio. But also people have been in print journalism for many, many years. People like Kathleen Schuckel and David Bangert.
Absolutely. Dave just retired from the Lafayette Journal and Courier, and he's one of our writers. And for those of us from Central Indiana, Janet Williams was at the Indianapolis Star for many years, along with Bill Theobald. In fact, Janet and Bill have produced some of our, most detailed, in-depth, long-form pieces about redistricting. You can tell we're proud, I think, justifiably, of the quality of the reporting. We don't treat our readers as though they, were in junior high school. The pieces that we publish treat our readers as educated folks who want to learn more about the pressing issues of the day, particularly those issues that affect the civic health of Indiana.
We know that that there's a push on in universities to get back to teaching civics in school, and some universities have already made plans to put that in some way in their curriculum, and there should be probably, I'm sure, more that will come in the future. But the Indiana Citizen is out there, at least to do it for now. And we've had with us Bill Moreau, who's the creator, the co-founder, I should say, along with his wife Ann, and the publisher of the Indiana Citizen. And Bill, thank you for spending time with us to talk about not only the online publication, publication, but the other things that happen as well, too, behind the scenes, such as the Indiana Citizen Education Foundation. And we hope to have a chance to delve on other issues like this and take you on as one of our contributing broadcasters here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thank you very much.
Oh, I'd love that, Chris. And don't forget, go to IndianaCitizen.org.
Thank you very much. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. There is a group of child advocacy groups around the country that have put together a petition to try to end what's called for-profit foster care here in the United States. And with us to talk about the problem of for-profit foster care, the impact that it has on tens of thousands of children in the United States, we have film producer Peter Samuelson, who's president of First Star, and he is one of the organizers of a petition that is out there. And Peter, thank you for joining us on the program today.
I'm so happy to have the opportunity. Thank you.
Will you explain to people some of the statistics? People may or not be aware of tens of thousands of children in the country live in foster care. They probably know that. But there are many, many, many youngsters who live in what are called for-profit foster care agencies. What are these agencies, and what kind of problems do they create for these children that have problems of their own and they're trying to just to grow up?
Well, in 2018, the Senate Finance Committee, on a bipartisan basis, studied this issue in great detail and determined that when foster care is run for profit, it is not only considerably more expensive to the taxpayer, but the outcomes for the children are dramatically worse. So our petition at fixfostercare.org is simply saying that the federal government, which pays for half of all foster care expenses, so those are our dollars, we're the taxpayers, they should, after a transition period, all foster care should either be run by local government itself or by a nonprofit charity. What it shouldn't be run by are any of these large, some of them traded publicly, companies that are making a buck on the heads of children. They operate at the moment in 28 states, and we think enough is enough. President Biden announced earlier this year that it is ethically unacceptable for federal incarceration to be run for profit. That's of convicted adult felons. Well, if that is the case, and I believe it is, why would anyone think that children who have done nothing wrong other than they're in foster care because they've had the grave misfortune to be born into a family where there is abuse or neglect, so the state has removed them from the birth parents, and now they've got to be put somewhere. And whether it is institutional placement in a group home or whether it is with individual families, the agencies that run this process should be charities or local government itself. They should not be for-profit companies. There's one company on the New York Stock Exchange that has done $2 billion in revenue. Don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. I'm a big capitalist. I believe in free markets, but there are exceptions in any sane civilization. You don't want the fire department, when they arrive because your house is on fire, you don't want them asking for a credit card before they take the hoses out to put out the blaze. Similarly, the only way to run foster care ought to be in the individual best interests of the children. And as the Senate Finance Committee showed conclusively, and we have all of the documentation and so forth on fixfostercare.org, mm-hmm. They just don't run it in the kids' best interests. So if we're going to do one large thing, we, the grown-ups, need to lift our hands, sign the petition on fixfostercare.org. We've got, last time I looked was over the weekend, and we had 335,000 signatures. We'd love to get it up to 433,000, because that's how many kids are in foster care in the United States. So all we're saying is either a charity or government, local government itself, should run foster care. It should not be run by profit-making companies. It's more expensive, and the outcome stats are dramatically worse. So fixfostercare.org, let's raise our hands for the individual children. They have nobody who is going to stand up for them. They'll never march. They don't vote. They haven't got any money. Most of them don't even know that their situation doesn't need to be this bad. It's, in a way, the last great civil rights struggle in the United States, in our country, that never had a day won. You've never read an op-ed by an underage 18 foster kid because of all the secrecy. So we need to change it. We need to say, here I am. These are legally our children. Once they are removed from abuse or neglect, they are now, you know, wards of the state. Who is the state? That would be us. And through our elected representatives and the people that they employ, we have to somehow run foster care. The last thing that we need is running it for profit. It started in Florida about 20 years ago. It's growing like kudzu grass, and we've now exported it to Europe as well. It's a very bad idea. It's unnecessary. It's more expensive. The outcome stats are dramatically worse. Please sign your name. It takes 30 minutes. It takes 30 seconds on fixfostercare.org. We're grateful for your attention.
I understand that people probably don't realize that once a young adult comes out of foster care, they don't always have all the advantages, certainly that other youngsters or young adults, for that matter, that haven't gone through foster care face. They may be more unemployed. They may be more homeless than many people believe.
Yes. Within 2 years of aging out of foster care across the country, half of all foster kids are unemployed, unhoused, incarcerated or deceased. It's not good enough. We spend as a country $83 billion a year. That's the size of a, you know, a good size war. We need to be a little more thoughtful, and we need to be putting money more into prevention of abuse or neglect. But also, once we have to deal with it because the abuse or neglect has happened, the very least we can do is not compound the damage to the children by putting them in situations where their individual best interests are not what guides the authority that's in charge of them. It shouldn't be for profit. Profit adds an extra layer of money to the cost. And the outcome stats, because the incentives within these for-profit entities are reverse incentives, how many kids can you cram into that group home? Mm-hmm. Every time you move a kid, we're going to pay you a bonus, and so on and so forth. It's egregious. My eyes were opened because a Chicago area lawyer called J. Paul Derritani, he was one of my students when I taught a class in script writing. And he was the mature student in the middle of the class, and we ended up having a coffee. And he told me this extraordinary story of how he represents foster kids. And I said, "This, what you just told me, it's like a John Grisham story. You should write it. You're getting your MFA in screenwriting." And he did write it. And I thought it was one of the best scripts I had ever read. And we raised the money. We made the film. Matthew Modine and Shane Paul McGee and Amy Brenneman and Lou Gossett Jr. The film has done very well. But what we're trying to do is to use the film as the spark plug. Right after Labor Day, we are going to Washington, and we're going to present the petition in the White House and in the Senate and in the House, possibly show the film. Don't know yet. We have 335,000 signatures. It's at fixfostercare.org. It would be a blessing if those listening could join the petition, and let's get another 100,000 on it, and then there would be one adult American citizen raising their hand and saying, "I'm here for you. You may be a child. You may have been abused or neglected. I recognize that you are my responsibility through my elected officials, and we're going to do a better job. So fixfostercare.org.
That's Peter Samuelson, president of First Star and the organizer of the petition campaign that is underway that you can see dealing with foster care and in turn to abolish for-profit foster care. The website is fixfostercare.org. Peter, thank you very much for being with us, telling us about the story, and we hope that the signatures come in so that you're able to take something to Washington to get something done. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Indiana State Senator Karen Talion is calling on the State Department of Workforce Development to stop demanding that Hoosiers who received what the Ogden Dunes lawmaker says are legitimate pandemic unemployment benefits to repay the state for those benefits. Talion was with us to talk about the issue and about her efforts, which go all the way up to the governor's office.
Last year, when the COVID put everybody shut down from work, we had a group of people who are normally not entitled to unemployment benefits. They are people that we kind of call the gig economy, people that are self-employed or that are independent contractors who don't get unemployment benefits, yet they were all out of work. And so the federal government put in a new type of unemployment insurance. It's called Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, PUA. And so a lot of these people were able to get some kind of relief during this COVID shutdown. Well, it's now, you know, months later, all those people used that money to live, essentially. And now the federal government and the state of Indiana are going back and revisiting all those claims and basically saying, you didn't fill this form out right. You didn't show exactly the documents that we asked for. And now you have to pay this money back. And, you know, we all know that during that period of time, there is what I would call organized crime, and I don't mean the mafia, but I mean organized scams, a lot of them from overseas, who would make claims for these benefits and built the United States out of lots of money. I'm not talking about those, of course. I'm talking about, you know, the person down the street who used to be an Uber driver or who was an independent contractor for somebody, a hair salon or whatever. And they applied for this money and they just didn't do it right. And our state of Indiana Department of Workforce Development, they have the ability to waive those repayment requests. And what I'm saying is that you know, we got $900 million from the feds that we put in. Basically, this was a gift to our unemployment trust fund. So it's not like our unemployment trust fund is out of money. And the second thing is that all those benefits, those PUA benefits, they were not paid out of our unemployment trust fund anyway. They were paid, you know, the payments came through there, but it was all federal money. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to say, look, you know, if you were a legitimate person that just didn't do it quite correctly, we can waive those repayments. And I think we should. The other thing that I just want to mention is that this is really a call out to the governor's office and to DWD because they are simply not presenting us with the information. I've been on this unemployment thing since COVID started over a year ago. and we were on weekly calls with workforce development to see how everything went. And now we've got this repayment game, and we're asking for information. How many people, how many claims, how much money, how many of these things were fraudulent? And I've been asking for that information since at least June, and now it's almost September, and we still have nothing. So, you know, our state government needs to respond to this and to help make life a little easier for some of these people who did nothing wrong.
Now, I understand that the federal government is going to end at least part of this program, perhaps all of it, next month. And I know that has an impact on getting the repayments for people that have been paid the unemployment benefits. And I know that that was part of the turnaround that was ordered by a judge. Do you think that this was going to continue on into September and later? Or will it basically the state will just basically let things end when everything ends in Washington?
There are two different things going on. So the program that ends in September is the benefits package. These are people who are still out of work, who are still making, you know, claims, who are getting extra money. And that is really, really a separate issue from the repayment of these PUA claims.
So you're still going to obviously push the Department of Workforce Development and even the governor's office to go ahead and get this information back to you, certainly, and to stop calling for these repayments of the benefits that have already been paid out.
That's right. That's right. And I did that op-ed piece, but as part of that whole effort, we're also doing a letter directly to the governor pointing this out.
Northwest Indiana State Senator Karen Talion. This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Ivy Tech Community College in Valparaiso has added classes to give students a chance to learn the skills that will lead to jobs in the growing broadband communications industry. Chancellor Otso Sikorski was originally speaking with us to talk about the 10-month program that's underway this fall that will provide participants with the necessary skills to work in fiber optics.
This program, what is being designed is to provide necessary skills to the students so they're going to be able to work with the telecom or brand industry in Northwest Indiana in particular, because we all know the fiber optic networks is expanding tremendously in pretty much in all communities here in Valparaiso, Chesterton, Porter County, Lake County, everywhere. And it's super important for us to provide these kind of programs and training opportunities for the students to earn those skills.
What types of jobs are available here in Northwest Indiana in particular that this particular Ivy Tech program is going to be able to help provide for people, men, women, children, I guess, young, we're talking about high school graduates in this case?
These are for the network technician, fiber optic technician, fiber optic cable installers. So those are the most common positions what these telecom or broadband companies they're offering. And that's what we wanted to make sure that the students will get the skills for these positions.
Have these jobs been offered, or are many of these cases new technology jobs, or are some of these jobs been around for a while that this particular program will help better prepare students to be able to look into?
These are relatively new skills, mm-hmm. I can call that way. Fiber optic, it's all the time, it's involving technology, and you have new equipment when it comes down for splicing, installment, and those kind of things. So we wanted to really make sure to the students to be able to operate on the latest technology, on the latest equipment, And again, I'm just mentioning, you know, fiber optics, pricing, and installation, because that is the most important at these times.
Are there many employers here in Northwest Indiana, or a growing number of employers, maybe I should say, that are involved in this type of work in broadband, certainly, and in this particular program, fiber optic cables and the like, that will be looking forward to having more people come on board if they get the education?
I can certainly mention at least a couple of those. NITCO, it's right here in Porter County, but they do the work in Lake County and soon probably in LaPorte County, when they're installing, you know, fiber optics networks in our communities. And they are one of the best partners. Even before this program, we partnered with them, and we did short-term training, you know, maybe just few days training for the fiber optic splicer installers. And again, great supporter from NITCO, and they're excited because of this partnership. They are serving on the program advisory committee for this program, so they know exactly what kind of training we offer, what we do, how we are organized, and it's out there. So extremely supportive of Ivy Tech.
Now, since this is a new program, at least here in Northwest Indiana within Ivy Tech Community College in Valparaiso, what does the program look like? Has it been set up with classes, or will be set up with classes over time to get the students ready and be able to look towards, once they finish the program, for the jobs that are ahead?
As I said, this is a 10-month program, but consists of a 16 college credit. Basically, that it's seven courses is being scheduled, and typically we are running these courses in the 8-week format session.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's going to be included the hands-on experience, the internships. That's all about this, as we called, earn and learn experiences. And the other exciting part is that this program is being recognized through the Workforce Ready grant offered through the state of Indiana, and more specifically, taking Hoosiers to the next level, which means this certificate, it will be paid fully, 100% through the state. So those individuals who they're interested to come and join the program, it will be tuition and books free.
So, that's great.
We already started with this program just last month, so to speak. I forgot it's September already.
Mm-hmm.
We started on August 18th, the first 8-week sessions, and our next start is going to be on October 20th. But right now, we are enrolling for the second cohort. So definitely, I like to use this opportunity and to invite all those individuals interested for these kind of high-paid, high-demand positions to join us and go through this, again, 10-month program, but it's free, so to speak, and being able to get those nice-paying jobs.
Chancellor Sikorski, does it look that if this program does well during the 10-month SEAL program, that this will become a more permanent part of the Ivy Tech Community College curriculum?
The certificate, what we are talking about, that is already in the books, so to speak, in the on Ivy Tech. We already have this certificate. But what is the difference, and we will continue to do, we are more intentional for the portion on the hands-on earn and learn or internships experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know and we recognize the gap when it comes down for the students when they are getting the skills, the education and knowledge in the classroom and the labs at Ivy Tech. It's extremely important for them to get that real hands-on experience. And this kind of partnership offers exactly those kind of experiences, which is really, really important for the success for the students as well as for the employers. So when the program is over, we are truly hoping, and the students are hoping, that they will be hired by these companies.
If anybody would like more information about this program that's underway now, knowing that there'll be more classes coming up from Ivy Tech Community College in Valparaiso, how can they find out more about it?
They can reach out via email at valparaiso-admissions@ivytech.edu. Again, it is valparaiso-admissions@ivytech.edu, or they can call us at 219-476-4000. 4701.
That is Ivy Tech Community College Valparaiso Chancellor Otso Sikorski. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks. Back with you tomorrow.